Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Robert Wilkie is the National Secretary for the Department of Veterans Affairs. In October of 2019, he toured South Dakota's Fort Meade Medical Center. He then spoke with SDPB's Lee Strubinger about rural health care delivery for veterans and tribal veterans. He also reassured South Dakotans about the future of the facilities in Hot Springs. You can find that interview on our website at listen.sdpb.org. But let's go back a little further, because in 2018, the U.S. Congress passed the Mission Act, directing VA to make changes in several key areas. It's complex reform that will impact veterans care for decades to come. And Secretary Robert Wilkie joins us on the phone now for an update. Thanks for being here, sir.
Well, thank you, Laurie. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this idea that this is not your grandfather's VA anymore.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about how veteran demographics and expectations have changed and how that sort of intersects with the Mission Act.
Sure. Well, the demographics have changed as the country has changed. In the military that I grew up, I was born into it, grew up in places like Fort Sill and Fort Bragg. In my father's day, when he was commissioned a couple of months before Kennedy was inaugurated, less than 0.5% of the force was female. Today, that number is close to 20%, and it may reach 25% by 2030. So that is a huge change in the makeup of the force. The other is the simplest one. In my father's day, the force was about 7 million strong, but it was constantly refreshed by draftees. Today, it's all volunteer, which means we have to work harder to keep people in the service than we did in my father's day. And part of that is making sure that Veterans Affairs is ready to receive them when they finish their service. Now, the Mission Act is the most transformative piece of legislation for VA since the GI Bill. What it does, it says that if you live a certain distance from a VA facility, and I was thinking of the Western United States when I wrote the regulations, then you have the opportunity to choose to go into the private sector, either a university health system or a private hospital or a community hospital or a community doctor or nurse. I thought it was absolutely ridiculous, and I saw it. I spent a lot of my youth in southwestern Oklahoma, so I know about the distances that people in the West have to travel. I thought it was ridiculous that we were making veterans drive 300, 400, 500 miles round trip, and they were passing facilities along the way just to get to VA. The other thing that we have done is that we've opened up urgent care for our veterans. If there is an urgent care facility near them, then they are able to visit that. The goal there is to keep them out of the emergency rooms, less pressure on the families, less pressure on them. And that's really where Mission has kicked off. The last part of Mission that we are working to implement is to close the final circle from Vietnam. And that is finally give financial and resource support to the families of Vietnam veterans who take care of those veterans at home. We had it for everybody but Vietnam. And as the son of a combat soldier from Vietnam, who my mother took care of my father in his last years, and I saw the impact on our family, we finally gotten around to recognizing the unique situation that our Vietnam veterans are in.
I'm also the daughter of a combat Vietnam veteran and a veteran myself. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is this notion of choice. What do you know about how often, what kind of data do you have about how often veterans choose VA when they could choose something else or would rather have their care at VA, and why?
Sure. Well, I have been telling the country that what I have seen is what you hinted at. Veterans are voting with their feet. Their first response is to stay in a place where people understand the culture and speak the language. You know that from your 6 years in the Marine Corps. That is the first response that most of our veterans have. Now, mission kicked off on June 6th. Since that time, we have authorized about 1.3 million appointments in the private sector. But during that same time, we've had 1.7 million more appointments within VA than we had at a similar time in the previous year. Our veteran appointment rate is at an all-time high within VA. So my goal was to offer the veteran the choice to allow that veteran to tailor the health care around the needs that he or she might have, make it easier for the families. And you know, more often than not, people are choosing to stay with us.
Right. And they're choosing culture, but they're also choosing quality, don't you think? And yes. There are certain things that VA really does better than anyone else based on research and the number of patients they see. PTSD care comes to mind. Some veterans, mental health care comes top of mind. There are certainly other things. And, of course, one of the knee-jerk reactions was this word, you know, you're trying to privatize something.
Right.
But address, if you will, the sort of balance between, you know, giving people choice to go somewhere else and building up the infrastructure and the resources.
Right.
You know, there's a financial balance there as well.
Yes. So let me address the privatization issue as I've addressed under oath. Only in Washington, D.C. Would someone who presented the largest budget in the history of a department, $220 billion, calling for 400,000 employees, would be accused of setting us on the road to privatization. The only way VA can be privatized is if the 535 members of the board on Capitol Hill decide that it will be privatized. But again, my goal is balance. And for those things that are particular to those like your father who have been in combat, there is nothing that the civilian sector does that comes close to what we provide. I look at my staff here. I am surrounded, and I did this on purpose. I'm surrounded by people who have served extensively. I'm surrounded by people who come from military families. And I think that spread out across 170 hospitals is a reason why veterans choose to come to us. And as I said, we have set all sorts of records this year, last year, 2019, for the number of appointments that we filled within our institution. And we have the highest patient satisfaction rates in our history. We're sitting at about 90%. Are there going to be bad things that happen? Yes. I mean, we're not immune from what the rest of society experiences. But this notion that I think grew up, certainly as a result of what happened in Phoenix with the wait times, that VA is not part of this equation anymore.
Mm. Let's talk about something as simple as improving wait times, because part of this new program is, you know, if you have to wait for a certain amount of time to make an appointment with your provider, you have a choice to go elsewhere.
Yes.
But how are those wait times looking?
Well, I won't give you any VA statistics. I'll go to the Journal of the American Medical Association. They're the ones who said that our wait times are as good or better than they are in the private sector. And I'll give you an example. When we are compared to the private sector, we're in very good shape. I just addressed an issue with a U.S. senator who was complaining that the wait times for specialty care surgery at the VA in his largest city were unacceptable. Well, the wait times for that surgery were 12 days at our VA. In that metropolitan civilian area, the wait times were 78 days, which goes back to your original point. Things are not always rosier in the private sector, and we strive to do as much as we can to make sure that those wait times are short. The new decision support tool that we have in addition to the electronic health record that we're bringing online in the Pacific Northwest in a few weeks, will also improve our ability to govern the wait times that our patients have. We are behind as an institution in terms of putting things in computers, and the electronic health record, which will allow veterans access to their records through websites, through our website. It will allow private caregivers, doctors, pharmacies, the ability to put information in. That's going to go a long way toward making sure that our wait times are even better.
You have spoken out about some of the residual efforts of previous administrations. Talk to me a little bit about President Trump and his enthusiasm for VA and for what's ahead.
Yeah.
And particularly, I want to talk about this idea of eliminating and reducing to the point of eliminating veteran suicides.
Yeah. Well, I was very happy as the Undersecretary of Defense working for General Mattis when this call came. I was the acting secretary for 8 weeks, and that's an interesting position to be in. You are the secretary, but you really aren't. But in those 8 weeks, I spent a total of about 8.5 hours with the president, either on the phone or in person. He was asking me questions about military life and about veterans in a way that I'd never been approached, and I work for George W. Bush in his White House. He's the only president to have ever made veterans the centerpiece of first his campaign and then his administration. So that in and of itself told me that this was somebody who was refusing to accept VA as it had existed under previous administrations, and that includes Republicans as well as Democrats. Suicide. This is something that people in South Dakota know about and have known about for well over a century, and I'll tell you why. The Army, the Frontier Army, first began taking statistics on Army suicide in the 1890s in the Dakota territories because the president, in this case it was Benjamin Harrison, was alarmed. He was a former soldier at the reports he was getting from the outposts as to the number of soldiers taking their lives, officers and enlisted. And we've had that steady number for well over 100 years, now verging on 130 years. So what we have done is we've made it our number one clinical priority. We are about to present to the president a national roadmap on suicide, which combines not only our efforts, but the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, HHS, DOD, and HUD, so that we have a clearer picture of what we need to do. One of the problems that we have as a country, and I've said this in testimony, is that we have never had a national conversation about mental health. The way we approach that at VA is that we have same-day mental health services, even for those who have been other than honorably discharged. In my youth, an other than honorable discharge meant that individual was not eligible for VA services, but we have changed that. Our biggest issue, and it's one that I addressed when I was in South Dakota when I was meeting with tribal representatives, is finding those veterans. Of the 20 veterans who take their lives every day, about 14 of those we don't see, so 70%. That's particularly true in tribal lands. And I need to get money, I need to get educational resources out into those communities so we can help them help us find those 14 veterans we don't see. And having spent, as I mentioned earlier, a great deal of my youth on the southern end of your Great Plains, I know of the particular problems that not only impact Native communities, but impact rural communities and also the distances and the special circumstances of living in Western America. And still, the highest number of veterans come from rural and native communities. It's not even close. And it's been that way for a long time. I just think that many people in Washington, of both parties, they still don't understand the scale of the American West. And here we are in 2020, and I'm still having that conversation with a lot of people.
You also mentioned earlier in our conversation that the shifting demographics and how many women veterans there are now compared to just a decade ago.
Right.
Tell me about how you sort of change infrastructure and provide, you know, how do you build those programs to get ready for the influx of female veterans?
And that's putting women's clinics in all of our hospitals and devoting money and resources to that. But it's also a process that has to begin when they're on active duty to make sure they know that everything that they see, they have seen from VA is available to them. You know, we are now in the process of making sure that, you know, we have things like daycare services available to our women veterans when they come in. Maternity services, and to make sure that we have the full range of services available to them. The military has changed, and the culture has to change to keep up with it.
So I have, when you say that, I got a little emotional because I cannot imagine walking in, you know, times are changing quickly.
Yeah.
You must have those moments,
right,
too, where you feel emotional about how
sure,
you know, the progress that's being made, really.
I will give you an example from childhood. So my father, senior officer in 82nd Airborne Division, and every Christmas there was a parade in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and the 82nd would lead the parade, or elements from the division wearing the red beret that they are famous for. And the thought of me as a child seeing women marching in the ranks of the most decorated of combat units, the 82nd Airborne, I mean, that was unfathomable. Today, people who are my age, or my age then, they don't think twice about it. The only other thing I would say about, and in my military career, so many of my superior officers have been women. I mean, I'd follow them anywhere. Some of them I've actually brought to VA in a civilian capacity. But there are still elements, and I'll be truthful about it, and I've said this in public, there's still elements. They tend to be older, who don't accept the changes in our society. And that is something that we have to address on a cultural level.
There are always hiccups with sweeping reform and with any large-scale operation. Some of those hiccups have come from reimbursement, you know, with I know Senator Mike Rounds talked about people contacting his office for reimbursement.
Right.
How do you handle those inevitable hiccups and work toward, like, are there systems in place to sort of monitor how things are being rolled out and improve them?
There are now. The Choice Act that was passed in 2014 and the result as a result of the scandals in Phoenix, Congress responded in a very haphazard manner. They demanded that an institution this large change its way of doing business in 45 days. People weren't getting paid. There were no systems in place. So what we have done with Mission is that we have now, there are five regions in the country. For four of those regions, we now have new vendors in place. And the fifth one will be coming on, I believe, in May. And that's for the Pacific Islands and the Philippines. What these folks are doing is paying what I call legacy payments first. Those claims, and it's primarily from community hospitals and small town clinics and doctors, we cannot make Mission work unless those folks are paid, because you can't have choice if you don't have partners in the civilian sector. So Senator Rounds' comments, and he and I have talked a great deal about that, are certainly being addressed, and I think we're in a much better place than we were when the Choice Act was passed now 6 years ago, and mission has certainly replaced that.
You also mentioned when you came to South Dakota last time a promise to visit the facilities in Hot Springs. I understand that you were close to making that happen.
I'm coming in March, I think. I'll be there for a few days and look forward to it. I need to see it. It is a place not only where veterans come, but they come because of its unique history and its unique place in the history of not only the state of South Dakota, but of the United States Army and the story of the Great Plains.
You have an aggressive traveling schedule, but you've seen so much. And the last question I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned working for Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. When President Trump announced that you were moving to this position, he was a little surprised. You were a little surprised. How do you see, now that you've had a chance to settle in, although everything is still, you know, really fairly new when you look at the big picture
of
things?
Well, it's a year and a half now.
You know, are you satisfied with this current position?
Well, I tell you, it is the best professional experience I've ever had. And, of course, it came out of the blue. General Mattis, as you pointed out, he used to say, "I was born in khaki diapers." I like that. and I see this as the other end of the national security continuum. We, as Mr. Lincoln said, we care for those who have borne the battle. I've enjoyed it. I think we're in a much better place. The president has given me incredible leeway to implement reform. And one other thing, and I don't want to end it on a negative note, but it's not particularly negative because it has a positive impact. We've let go 8,000 people who were not fulfilling their oaths. That's unprecedented in the federal government. So holding people accountable has sent a message to our veterans and to the workforce, and I think it's important.
Robert Wilkie is National Secretary for the Department of Veterans Affairs. We'll make sure that we're in Hot Springs when you are to hear your thoughts on that visit as well. Thank you so much.
And I thank you and look forward to seeing you.